Hello, I'm Dan Miles. This is number 0123 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0123. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Ivan J. Houston, who is the author of Black Warriors, the Buffalo Soldiers of World War II.
There were black infantrymen. We were Buffalo Soldiers because our division wore the Buffalo patch. And we fought in Italy from August 1944 until May 1945 when the war ended in Italy, and that we lost a lot of men there, and some of my comrades are still buried in the U.S. military cemetery in Florence, Italy.
Paul J.J. Payak of the Global Language Monitor talks about the top words and phrases of 2011.
We look at the English language globally. We survey it from around the world, from Beijing to Sydney to Montreal to your backyard, and we try to find out exactly what's being used and what's actually making a cultural impact.
Michael Sykes is the president of the International Center for Bathroom Etiquette. What will you find when you visit their website?
We've got tips for how you might deal with a whole different range of, you know, bathroom scenarios, different number of urinals, tips to deal with going to the bathroom at work, at home, at the stadium. And then, you know, we've got a blog where we're just covering different bathroom stories, anecdotes. You dig deep into there, you can find some of your celebrity bathroom anecdotes. There's a lot of stuff on there.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff. And, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0123 was Dan Miles, who is the host of the Friends of Dan Music podcast, which is based in Phoenix, Arizona. Dan interviews some of the finest musicians in the world on his Phoenix-based Friends of Dan Music podcast. And you can check out his website by going to friendsofdanmusicpodcast.com. Very simple and easy to do. That's friendsofdanmusicpodcast.com. And thank you very much, Dan, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff. Okay, many people listening have probably faked a sick call into work to get a day off. 45-year-old Scott Bennett of Brookville, Pennsylvania, has transformed the practice into a true art form. Authorities say Bennett actually published a fake obituary for his living mother in a ploy to get paid bereavement time off from work. Relatives called the Jeffersonian Democrat newspaper after the obit appeared to report the woman was actually alive and well. Bennett's mother herself then visited the paper. Unfortunately, her son was then arrested and charged with disorderly conduct. Democrat editor Randy Bartley says he accepted the obituary in good faith after being unable to confirm the funeral arrangements at press time. Police Chief Ken Dworick says Bennett wrote up the memorial notice because he didn't want to get fired for taking time off. Well, you know, I have a feeling that having time off will no longer be a problem for Mr. Bennett. Well, I hope you had a good Christmas day and you're still enjoying what's left of the holiday season. You know, we're told that Christmas season is supposed to be a time when hard hearts soften and peace and goodwill towards one another is in the air. Well, not always the case, it seems. In Sweetwater, Florida, police have arrested two women for stealing Christmas decorations from their neighbor's yard and then putting them up on display in their own yard less than a block away. You know, because nobody would notice that. Yeah. About $500 worth of decorations were taken, including Mickey Mouse on a horse hugging penguins, Snoopy on a doghouse, and a Santa in the sled. So clearly the victim has very good Christmas decor taste. Anyway, the theft was all caught on surveillance video, so the crooks don't stand a chance. But police have not released their names. And due to the value of the decorations, this one is considered grand theft. And we're pretty sure they're earning a prominent place on the North Pole's naughty list for this year and all the years to come. Now, do you still get a lot of Christmas cards over the holiday period? Ad man Bob McCauley of Pittsburgh has been sending out holiday cards for years. However, the 400 people who got a card from Bob this year probably won't forget it anytime soon. You see, Bob sadly passed away in August at the age of 88. But prior to his death, he made arrangements for the cards to go out anyway, with a most unusual message. McCauley's card read, "Hello, please don't call. I recently moved to a quiet neighborhood. My new place doesn't have a phone, and our gates close after dark." Pictures on the card show the gates at Allegheny Cemetery in Lawrenceville and McCauley's tombstone. Friends said a relative helped produce the card. Longtime friend of McCauley, David Newell, said, "It was the strangest feeling getting that card. It was almost eerie, but when I opened it, I laughed out loud. It was the ultimate Christmas card." McCauley was known for his darkly funny Christmas greetings. You gotta love that sense of humor. You gotta love it. It's great stuff. Anyway, finally, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, authorities in Sacramento, California say one woman was so determined to convince her husband to move to a safer neighborhood that she faked her own rape. Oh, and she's a prison psychologist, I may add. Charges filed by the Sacramento County District Attorney allege that Lori Ann Martinez conspired with a friend to create the appearance that she was beaten, robbed, and raped by a stranger in April in her Sacramento home. She allegedly split her own lip with a pin, scraped her knuckles with sandpaper, had her friend punch her in the face, and even wet her pants to give the appearance she had been knocked unconscious. What's worse is police detectives and crime scene investigators spent hundreds of hours and God knows how many taxpayer dollars on the case until one of Martinez's prison co-workers finally came forward to say Martinez had been talking at work about faking a crime at her home to persuade her husband to move. Martinez then confessed the fake rape to police. The really crazy thing is the plan didn't work because 6 months after she staged the attack, Martinez and her husband filed for divorce. So now she's been arrested on conspiracy charges and a warrant has been issued for her friend's arrest on the same charges. Well, you know, in the long run, she's going to get her wish. She will have a new address. Not one she wants, but one she gets. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. The U.S. Armed Forces during World War II assigned many black service members to non-combat positions. African Americans served as drivers, cooks, and laborers, but the segregated military shied away from placing them in battle. However, the 92nd Buffalo Soldier Infantry Division was one of the few exceptions. One of those Buffalo soldiers was Ivan J. Houston, and he's the author of Black Warriors, the Buffalo Soldiers of World War II. Ivan joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Ivan.
Good morning.
Nice to have you on the program, sir. First off the bat, one of the things about World War II and basically any veteran is so many of the veterans, you hear people say in their family that, oh, dad or grandpa doesn't want to talk about what happened in the war. Was that a situation that you went through, and what made you decide to write this book now?
Well, because it's been about over 60 years after the war ended that I decided to write, but it was a bit of history that so many people didn't know. They didn't realize that, number one, the Army was segregated in those days, and number two, that there were black infantrymen. We were Buffalo Soldiers because our division wore the Buffalo patch, and that we fought in Italy from August 1944 until May 1945, when the war ended in Italy, and that we lost a lot of men there, and some of my comrades are still buried in the U.S. military cemetery in Florence, Italy.
It was a time before pre-Civil Rights era. It was a time when blacks were somewhat marginalized in the United States. There was a draft, but a lot of the blacks weren't drafted. How did you get involved in the war in the first place?
Well, I was a student at the University of California at Berkeley. when you became 18, you were either drafted or you enlisted in the Army or the Navy or whatever. You were in the armed forces anyway. So I enlisted with the full intent of the Army had a program of going back to college, and then after you graduated, you become a lieutenant. However, they broke that program up in March 1944 and sent all of us, there were white soldiers and black soldiers in this program, we all were sent to the infantry because I think they were getting ready to invade Europe at Normandy, and they knew they were going to lose a lot of people, so they needed a bunch of young guys like me to fight.
So what was it like getting over that hurdle? As I said in the introduction, most of the blacks were in non-combat positions. When and how did you get the opportunity to actually do your part in the war?
There was only one U.S. Black infantry division in the U.S. at that time. That was the 92nd, and those about 400 or 500 black college students were sent that were in the program were sent to that division, and we were most of the enlisted men. All the enlisted men in the division were black. Well, all of our senior officers were white. The junior and officers were some black and some white. And the enlisted men were, for the most part, from the South, and many were illiterate. So it was quite a combination of those of 300 or 400 of us who had some college training and a pretty good education, and several thousand men who came from the Deep South that had no education.
Did that makeup cause any racial or cultural tensions? And I'm not just saying between blacks and whites, but but blacks and educated blacks, for instance.
Yeah, the only place where I ever had any fights was in the Army. I knew how to take care of myself because I took boxing at UC Berkeley, and I always liked boxing. Joe Louis, the heavyweight champion at that time, was one of my role models. And I had two fights in the Army against guys who just didn't like the way I talked. And for the fact that even though I was an athlete, I knew how to type. And I think that anybody who knew how to type, was a sissy or something like that. So I had fights, and I fortunately won everything. And I got along very well after that.
They often say that war is horror, and a lot of people aren't necessarily prepared for it when it comes their way. What was the most harrowing thing for you in battle when you first got over there?
Harrowing things for me? It was, you're 19 years old. You're looking at it. To me, it was sort of like an adventure initially. But pretty soon you begin to lose some of your friends, and you know that this is a terrible thing. And I never was really afraid that I was going to get killed. I did get wounded, but in the shoulder shrapnel toward the very end of my combat experience, but that was so fast that I was just sent to the medic, wrapped up, and sent on back to combat. So, it was. I learned an awful lot about people when I was in the Army, and about all kinds of people. But it was an experience that I wouldn't want to go through again, but something that I learned a great deal from.
You received a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star, correct?
Yes, I did. Yeah, the Purple Heart for being wounded on April the 9th, 1945, when I was blown through a door. And the Bronze Star came about because of, at that time I got the Combat Infantryman's badge for what they call exemplary action against the enemy. And after the war, all of us who received the Combat Infantryman's Badge that was elevated to the Bronze Star.
It's interesting when I asked the question that you quickly retold that date. Is that a date that is marked in your mind forever?
Forever, absolutely. I'll never forget that date, April the 9th, 1944, just 1945, rather, just north of, it was north of Pisa. Pisa, where Leaning Tower is, it was the first thing I saw when I got online.
Now, when this is a time period and also a piece of history that a lot of younger people, especially young blacks, are not necessarily aware of, do you think more should be done, including your book, you think more should be done to bring about the importance of the Buffalo Soldiers? I know, for instance, there's a new film coming out talking about the Tuskegee Airmen, which is another group of black military personnel. Do you think there should be more to tell your story?
Well, I think so. Tuskegee Airmen, they get, I think, always in the movies, the airmen get more attention than those of us who fought on the ground. But because I guess it was more glamorous to movies. But yes, I certainly do. I know Spike Lee had a movie, The Miracle at St. Anna, which was about our division. But it was fictional. What I've written in the book comes from the actual journal that I helped maintain, and it's real. It actually tells you sometimes minute by minute, sometimes hour by hour, day by day, what actually was happening with us.
Did you, or are you still in contact with any of the fellows that you went to war with, and what are their thoughts about you writing this book and telling essentially their story?
Well, most of the people that I was in contact with, and not too many, have unfortunately passed because I was young. I'm 86 years old now, but most of the friends that I was with in the Army have passed. And I know many of them have seen the book and read the book, and they really like it because I put both photos and maps in the book that actually shows where we were.
Hmm. And you also had a very productive life after the war as well. You became a businessman and a CEO, correct?
Yeah, I was the CEO of one of the largest African-American businesses in the country. It was headquartered in Los Angeles, an insurance company, which unfortunately, I retired over 20 years ago. The business went out a couple of years ago. But yes, and I had a career. I was on several major Fortune 500 boards. So I've had a very, very busy career. And I think that's one of the things that kept me from writing. I was busy doing other things.
Well, it's a very important story. I'm glad you did find the time to write it. The book is called Black Warriors, The Buffalo Soldiers of World War II. It's written by Ivan J. Houston. People can check out the website, which is blackwarriorsbook.com. And Ivan, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
I certainly appreciate your calling, and I enjoyed talking with you.
Ivan J. Houston, author of Black Warriors, The Buffalo Soldiers of World War II. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0123, and you'll find links to Ivan's website, plus links to also Amazon.com, where you can order the book directly for the Kindle.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the words and phrases that were on the top of the list in 2011. And we'll also talk to the president of the International Center for Bathroom Etiquette. Plus, of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. Okay, let's say you're homeless and you find a lost credit card on the ground. Do you return it? Use it to buy food and booze, or go and get a pedicure? Inexplicably, 27-year-old homeless man Jonah Lee Troutman chose the latter and told Volusia County Sheriff's deputies that he thought it was a blessing from God when he spotted the card on the ground. He then headed straight to Nancy's Nails and asked for a pedicure, but when the owner of the business ran the credit card, it was declined twice. Deputies were called, and Troutman told them he thought it was a gift card. He also told deputies he knew it wasn't his. Troutman told deputies he was homeless, so they arranged accommodations for him at the Volusia County Branch Jail, where he faces charges of petty theft and illegal use of a credit card. A pedicure? Seriously? Wow. Anyway, a 12-year-old upstate New York boy may be wishing that his dog ate his homework. Police in the village of Liberty used a sheet of math homework to track down a boy suspected of breaking into an auction house. The owner said he arrived Sunday morning and discovered that a window had been removed and jewelry, cell phones, video games, and other items had been stolen from his business. But a sheet of homework with the suspect's name on it was found in the woods behind the auction house. Police tracked down the boy and charged him with burglary. Because of his age, no names have been released. His case is being handled by the Sullivan County Family Court. Hey, at least the kid does his homework. Points for that. Moving right along, L.B. Williams, a black man married to a white woman in Panama City, Florida, reported that the Ku Klux Klan had burned a cross in his driveway in November and left a threatening note. However, the note did not demand that the couple move from the neighborhood. It demanded that they stay. Now, since the Klan is not known for supporting mixed-race couples, the police were suspicious and ultimately charged Williams with making the threats himself to frighten his wife into abandoning a divorce proceeding that she had recently requested. And now, you know, this guy was almost the idiot of the day, but he's not. That comes later. And I'm guessing, by the way, the divorce is still a go. A man in Woodstock, Georgia, noticed a strange car parked on his street. To discourage people from parking on the public street, he posted two signs on the car, one that said car bomb and another that said 50-foot clearance IED for improvised explosive device. The woman who owns the car parked it there because she got a flat tire. Before she could get back to change that tire, someone called the police about the suspicious circumstances. Officers, unsure if it was really a bomb or not, cordoned off the area and quickly traced the signs back to Anthony Richard Kaus III, age 43, perhaps in part because he apparently posted photos of his handiwork on Facebook. Kaus was charged with creating a false public alarm and making terroristic threats and was jailed on $22,400 bond. You know, if he was so keen on posting signs, why didn't he just try one that said, No parking. Just a thought. Moving right along, Mark Thomas Walk of Palm City, Florida, was unclear why he was being taken to jail. Yes, he perhaps got drunk and shot his lawnmower. Yes, maybe he pulled a shotgun on his son after the 18-year-old wrestled his pistol from him. And yes, it may have taken three shocks from the sheriff's deputy's taser to get him under control and into handcuffs. But the 43-year-old stated that he shoots in the yard all the time and that fighting is what redneck people do. Yeah, well, taking people to jail is what cops do. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an ambulance crew called police in Newport, Tennessee because of the nature of a man's injuries. Scott K. Kelly, age 38, had allegedly stabbed himself with a meat thermometer, and sure enough, police observed a small hole in his abdomen. When officers asked Kelly why he did it, he allegedly replied that he wanted to see if he was done or not. Wow. No matter what the thermometer says, I think he's pretty much done. What I want to know is, who actually called the ambulance? That's what I want to know. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Paul J.J. Payak is back on the show with us once again, so that means we must be close to the end of another year. Paul is with the Global Language Monitor, and this year marks the 12th annual survey of global English, a look at the top words, phrases, and names of the year. Paul joins us via Skype-to-Skype communications from Austin, Texas. Hi, Paul. Nice to have you back on the show.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
So what are some of the big words for 2012, or 2011 rather, and are there any surprises as far as you're concerned?
Well, the surprise is that the number one word of the year, Occupy, didn't even surface until September, okay, when the Occupy Wall Street movement started. It's been, of course, people use it for occupation of Iraq, which is ending, so-called occupied territories in Palestine, etc. But it's the Occupy Wall Street movement that really gave it the momentum. And what we do is we look at this thing, we look at global English globally, right? We look at the English language globally, and we survey it from around the world, from Beijing to Sydney to Montreal to your backyard. And we try to find out exactly what's being used and what's actually making a cultural impact. And it seems like the word occupy, according to our statistics, was far and away number one, about 50% higher in citations in the media, et cetera, than this number two, which was deficit.
Okay, so deficit, we've had a pretty bad economy for the last little while. Deficit has been around for some time, has it not?
Yes, it's been around for a long time, but it's been one of the top words for the last, at least since 08 and before that, okay? And since we've had the world economic restructuring, deficit has risen to prominence, but it's different. It's always seems to be, in the last, since 08, 9, 10, and now 11, what's happening is that a lot of the financial terminology or things relating to the worldwide economic restructuring have dominated, or at least have positions of dominance on our list.
When you determine the words, phrases, and names that are on a list, are you basing it on how they're being used or how often they're being used in the media?
Well, what we do is we look at it on how often they're being used in general, and then the media. In other words, to make our list, you have to be in the media at least 25,000 times. And then you have to have geographic depth, and you have to have geographic width and geographic depth. Now, what we're talking about is that it has to be used wherever English is spoken, which is, you know, English is now the global language. There's 300 million people studying English in China right now. So you have to see in a Peking Daily and in the different Chinese newspapers, the media, the television. It has to be in India. It has to be worldwide. Okay, so it has to have at least 25,000 citations, and it has to have the requisite that it's worldwide. And it's not just a little group. Like, in other words, if gamers had, if we did the number one gamers word, it would be noob. Okay, but with noob 5 and 10 years ago, which means a newbie, right? Somebody new at a game, and it's like a serious disrespect. You know, Peter is a newbie at a game, and that's not good. You don't want to be a noob, and it's actually spelled N00B, okay? But it took a long time, at least a half a decade, before it surfaced into the general public where people would use things like noob once in a while. So it can't just be in one community. It has to be in many communities. And then it has to have that geographic width. It has to have the depth, et cetera, et cetera. It has to be in scholarly papers. It has to be in books, magazines, television, newspapers. It has to be on the stoop file. It doesn't count. If it's not used in the stoop file, it doesn't count. That's one of the rules we have.
Okay, so let's look at some of the – we've mentioned some of the top words as far as ranking is concerned. We said Occupy was one, Deficit was two. I'll just very quickly mention Fracking, Drone, and Non-Veg are in the top five. Number six, Cummerspec. I've never even heard of that one. I didn't even know that was an English word.
Well, it's actually – just evolving in the language. And we always try to put a couple words that have made what we look at momentum and we look at velocity. So if there's words that aren't like number one in total number of usage, if you go to Google and type in Occupy, right, or any search engine, you see that it has many, many uses in the news, etc. But we also look at velocity. Okay, and momentum, meaning how much has a word changed in the last 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. And so something like Cummerspec, it all started with this little article that appeared in an obscure journal that said 15 words that you don't have English words for. Now, of course, that's impossible because we have over a million English words and we have at least three words to describe everything in the universe, on the planet, and beyond. And so Cummerspeck is a German word that means grief bacon. And basically it means emotional, we call it emotional overeating. So we do have a linguistic phrase, emotional overeating, that you can find many times. But Cummerspeck is interesting because it was introduced and then people are taking it up now. It's interesting. And then a really twist is that we found that in China, that they have they've taken the word Cummerspec from the English now, seen on the English language sites, and have translated into youthful sorrow. And that is the anxiety that the youth are feeling around the world that's being evidenced in all these different movements in different ways. Hmm. And so we thought that was interesting. So you take this thing from German, it goes to English, but the nature of global English right now is that the Chinese see it, and then they do something creative with it, and then it goes from there.
Okay, let's look at some of the phrases very quickly because we're a little short on time here. You also have top 10 phrases of 2011. Number one being Arab Spring, understand that. Number two, right. Royal Wedding. Number three, anger and rage. Didn't realize that was even a common phrase.
Right. Well, that's the characterization of the global electorate. Okay. And we keep hearing about people are angry. People and they tie it together with rage. We actually did a study on it and found that it's more frustration than anger and rage. But you can see in the Arab Spring, anger and rage came to the top. The interesting thing in the next one is climate change is number four, and climate change has been one of the top words as long as we've been – one of the top phrases as long as we've been taking a survey. It's amazing. It's like people are concerned. Now, they're not saying it's good or it's bad. They just know that it's changing. And you're up in Montreal, but you broadcast worldwide. But I know I grew up in New York, and I know 10,000 years ago – New York was covered with 5,000 feet of ice, 1 mile of ice, a kilometer and a half of ice. I mean, that's an incredible thing to think about, that it was so recent. So we know, the Great Lakes are puddles left from the glacier. They weren't there before the glacier. And that's how recent the glacier receded. And so we know the climate is changing without question. And then the political aspects, come in. But the world knows the climate is changing. And so that's always one of our top phrases.
Okay, let me look quickly at the top names in the few moments we have left. Number one, Steve Jobs. Number two, Osama bin Laden and SEAL Team 6 together is the top names of the year. Number three, Fukushima, which is the epicenter for the Japanese triple disaster of the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdown. Number four, number four, the Tunisian fruit vendor who set himself on fire.
Right. He's the guy that started the whole Arab Spring movement.
Mohamed Bouazizi.
Right. He didn't try to do that, but he set himself on fire. He didn't actually die at the time. But he set himself on fire protesting. He just couldn't take it anymore. And he just said, okay, I'm going to set myself on fire, which is kind of like an odd way to think about things. But that's what he did. And that really started the Tunisian spring. And then that's where it spread from around the world. So somebody like that has the momentum, right? It's not like everybody's talking about it. In select media and everything, his name was nowhere, and all of a sudden it's very high.
I just find it interesting. I just find it interesting that Mohamed Bouazizi's name is at number four is ahead of Kate Middleton, who is number six, Muammar Gaddafi, who's number seven, President Obama, who's number eight.
Well, he had to do something this year, okay? And we have pigs, the the Euro crisis, you know, with Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. They call that pigs. I don't think they actually. I think the Germans made that one up, okay, because the Southern Europe doesn't really like that name. And then we have the Yaroslav locomotive. Now, let me say something about Kate, okay, Kate Middleton, that we have different rankings. Like, we do the top television words, the top things from movies, the top things from fashion. And Kate Middleton was one of the great, you know, she was number one in fashion this year. But as a news stories, and we rank news stories, too, I mean, the royal wedding was beyond anybody's expectations. Beyond. I mean, we knew that the royal, you know, the royal couple, you know, has fans in the world, but this was unbelievable. The media attention. CNN had 200 or 300 people in London. Mm. Okay, and so you may like that or not, but it's just like the media attention. But the last thing I'd like to say is that Steve Jobs. He was twice as high as Obama bin Laden's death, as Osama bin Laden's death.
Yeah.
He was twice as high of the assassination of bin Laden. Now, that is incredible.
Right.
And iPod is like one of the top words of last year. Amazing. It's one of the top news stories. The iPod, the whole group of products that this one man created, not only does his name number one, but it's also his products are some of the biggest news stories. And for a product, that's like unbelievable.
Interesting that Kate Middleton was that high on the list and no word of or sign of Pippa. But anyway, that's all that's all the time we have. People can check out the website, which is www.languagemonitor.com. I thank you very much, Paul, for being on the program with us once again.
Now, remember, we can't use any of these words unless you use them. So I'm happy you said Mohamed Bouazizi, because otherwise we'd have to take it off the list if it's not on the Stoop file.
There you go. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Paul J.J. Payak from Global Language Monitor. Again, you can visit their website at www.languagemonitor.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0123, and you'll find links to Paul's website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. It's time to announce my favorite story of the year, and it comes from Connecticut. Last March, I told you that public trails there were in danger of being closed because of lawsuit fears. A bicyclist who had crashed on one of those trails sued and received a $3 million award. After that, local government started talking about closing their trails, so a grassroots effort was started to try to keep them open to the public. Citizens and conservation clubs contacted their lawmakers and demanded protection for the municipalities that owned the land. And, after several public hearings, the state's General Assembly finally passed a bill that gave local governments immunity from being sued over injuries that happen on the trails. Let's be fair, the court should be doing a better job of dismissing lawsuits like the one that made this new law necessary. It took a lot of work by volunteers to get this new law enacted, but I'm happy to say that it's already in effect, and just in time to keep the trails open for sledding. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you're listening to this while walking with your iPod, make sure you look both ways before you cross the street. It's safety first on The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the president of the International Center for Bathroom Etiquette. And of course, as always, we do have an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. Now, when her sister died, Eileen Lieberman says her family canceled the registration on her car and turned in her license plate. Yet 3 months later, a ticket was mailed to the woman after supposedly being caught on camera running a red light. Now, Lieberman says when she called to object to the citation, she was told that the driver dying long before the ticket was issued was not a valid excuse to get it thrown out and that someone's got to pay that ticket or go to court. You gotta love bureaucrats, huh? Lieberman, who happens to be a Broward County, Florida County Commissioner, vows to get death added as a valid exemption under the law. Well, this brings new meaning to the term stiff penalty, doesn't it? Actually, I was kind of hoping she'd just send her sister to court. Ooh, that'd be kind of icky. Anyway, anyone want to take a guess at what the first beer in outer space is? If you guessed Natural Light, congratulate yourself. Turns out Natural Light became the first beer launched into space thanks to efforts of a couple of Facebook fans. Two guys, identified only as Danny and Rich, approached the Natural Light folks with the idea, and they said, go for it, just let us know when you shoot it off. So the boys built a small rocket out of a styrofoam cooler containing a single can of Natural Light. Actually, it was basically more of a weather balloon than a rocket. The makeshift spacecraft reached an altitude of more than 90,000 feet, which is officially outer space. This is all on YouTube, so if you want to go watch, yes, I have put the link to the video on the Stuff File website. Just go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0123, and you'll find it. Unfortunately, just for scientific reasons, I'm going to tell you this piece of information. Drinking beer in outer space is not only not really doable, but it's possibly dangerous, as there's not enough gravity to keep the fluid in your stomach. Now, because you still need to vent that carbon dioxide that is expanding inside your belly, when you try to burp, you end up venting the carbon dioxide, beer, and whatever else was inside your stomach through your mouth and nose. This, my friends, is called a wet burp, an explosive near-vomit experience guaranteed to gross out anyone who has the misfortune to be floating around in space near you. Fortunately, earlier this year, Sabre Astronomics Australia and Four Pines Brewing Company partnered to create the first space beer, which can be consumed on Earth and up above. Jason Hell, director of Sabre Astronautics, explains, the gases in the liquids don't like to separate in zero gravity, so we've reduced the carbonation a bit and given a really strong flavor to the beer. Yes, science marches on. And just in case you thought you missed it, no, we still don't have a cure for cancer. Anyway, still to come on the program, we do indeed have an idiot of the day, but before we get to that point of the show, we have time for one more guest. A couple of weeks ago on this program, we shared with you in the Stuff File News a story about the world's first urine control video game that was installed at the Exhibit Bar Men's Room in London, England. Now, I thought we would delve deeper into the bathroom by talking to Michael Sykes. He is the president of the International Center for Bathroom Etiquette, and he's on the line with us from San Diego. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing tonight?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So I'm sure you've heard about this bar in London, and I'm just curious to get your thoughts, being the president of the International Center for Bathroom Etiquette, and how you feel about this particular establishment and what they've done in the men's room.
Well, you know, I have mixed feelings about it. You know, on one hand, you're going to the bathroom, it's dead time, and a lot of people might like something to do. On the other hand, you kind of get this feeling that it's like the last bastion of privacy, and it's, you know, just leave me alone in there. So I think it's going to have, you know, a mixed reception with the general population.
Well, it's not like you have to play the game, and it does bring in what seems to be the natural guy's sense of competition, shall we say.
Yeah, no, I think, and you're absolutely right. Nobody's forcing you to take part in it, but I guess it's just the idea that, you know, there's that screen
blaring, not necessarily blaring, but, you know, flashing at you right while you're trying to do your business. But, you know, as far as, especially in the venue, you know, it's not like this is in a public library. You know, so I think in the venue, it could turn out to be pretty popular. As you say, a couple guys end up in there and get a little competitive.
Well, as from the story that we had on the program, and I'll read the story here, basically the way they plan to do it. The game was designed to create a valuable media opportunity for the, as they say, 55 seconds the average male spends while he pees just staring at the wall. Now, a short ad plays before the game, promoting a drink special at the bar. Then players fire away to control the game and try to score points. And at the end of the game, players are encouraged to post their scores to Twitter and to a live leaderboard so they can compete with their friends. So you don't necessarily have to compete with your friends, shall we say, side by side, but it's an accumulative thing, I guess, much like a pinball machine where you try to beat the best score.
So my question here, and this is something I actually looked into and I wasn't able to get the answer to, is how do you post your score? I mean, do you actually have to touch the monitor in the bathroom to do that? So are guys like going pee, handling their junk, and then touching the monitor, and then I'm supposed to go in and touch it later on too?
I don't know. That's a very good question. So, or maybe it's It keeps score by itself, if you know what I mean. I have no idea how that works.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's my main concern here. You know, when you talk getting into the whole etiquette and cleanliness and hand wash and all these kind of things, is, I mean, if you can leave the bathroom and then maybe go outside and upload your score once you've washed your hands, that's one thing. But if you have to do it right then and there, I don't know if that's going
to
work.
I guess it's going to take a little more investigating on our part to find out exactly what's going on there. Would you, if you had the opportunity to visit the exhibit bar in London, England, would you try it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I'm all for, you know, new experiences in the bathroom, trying to, you know, make things a little more interesting in there. And I'd love to give it a shot. I want to see what kind of high score I can get.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about your organization, the International Center for Bathroom Etiquette. How long has it been around, and why did you start it?
Well, it's been around in one form or another since about 1995. So, you know, when you start talking about websites and internet presence, we're you know, the granddaddies of, you know, bathroom websites. But, you know, and I started really because people have, no pun intended, piss poor bathroom etiquette. And, you know, I was using a bathroom frequently when I was in college where there was, you know, it must have been 15 urinals and a bunch of sinks, and the paper towel dispenser was right beside one of the urinals, and guys would come in and they'd always use that urinal when there were 14 other ones available. And I'm just thinking, you know, there are guys that need to be educated on the finer points of bathroom etiquette. And then things kind of just snowballed from there.
Now, you mentioned guys need to be educated on the finer points. And that's a general theory that most people have. But do women need to be educated as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I say guys, I really meant that's how things started. And being a guy myself, I suppose male bathroom etiquette is really my specialty. I'd love to do some research in the women's bathroom, but I think I'd get arrested. Look, all the stories I've heard say that women are just as bad in terms of things like cleanliness and not washing hands and whatnot. And so I'd love to say that, this is a male problem, women are perfect, but I don't think that's the case.
Well, it's funny you say that, because as a teenager, I used to work in a movie theater as an usher, and one of the jobs the ushers had to do was to maintain the washrooms through the course of the business day. And it always startled me at how much worse the ladies' room was to the men's.
And I think it's, you know, we have, especially I think as men, this vision of women being these delicate flowers, they don't sweat, they're clean, they're tidy, or whatever. But, you know, I think behind closed doors, those places get pretty gross.
So what will people learn when they go to the website, which, by the way, is www.icbe.org for International Center for Bathroom Etiquette? What will people learn, what will people find out when they go to your website?
Well, you know, we've got tips for basically just, you know, how you might deal with a whole different range of, you know, bathroom scenarios, different number of urinals, tips to deal with going to the bathroom at work, at home, at the stadium. And then, you know, we've got a blog where we're just, you know, covering different bathroom stories, anecdotes. You dig deep into there, you can find some of your celebrity bathroom anecdotes. There's a lot of stuff on there. I mean, I absolutely think that, you know, everybody owes it at least a 5-minute check on it and take a look and see what's going on.
Oh, it's a good thing you brought up the idea of bathroom etiquette at stadiums. I didn't even think that was possible. To me, stadium washrooms are just a modern-day version of anarchy, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you know, and the truth is, you're 100% correct. That's what I call a special situation, you know, and I'm the president of the International Center for Bathroom Etiquette, so believe me, I take this stuff seriously. But people get a little uptight, and they say, "Wow, oh my God, bathroom etiquette." But look, it's the stadium. It's halftime. It's intermission. There's 10,000 people trying to go. At some point, etiquette stands aside, and you just have to get your business done. So you stop worrying about, you know, maybe giving people quite as much personal space. You still wash your hands. You know, you're still not going to clap people on the back while they're in the middle of going pee. But, you know, things get a little looser in those situations.
Okay, some of the typical guy rules we always talk about, for instance, no talking in the restroom. Is that something that is followed through in etiquette, or are people allowed to talk? I'm a non-talker, by the way, in that regard.
I think talking is a no-no. And, you know, and again, it varies. You know, at the stadium, you know, people are drinking the game. You know, you might exchange a word or two, but I think the one time where you really want to avoid the talking is at work. And you get these really uncomfortable scenarios. You know, what if your boss starts talking to you? You can't very well ignore your boss, and you get these really awkward situations. But I think, you know, best thing is no talking in the bathroom. And I know that's another thing that women are different, too. You know, women get that whole social experience. They'll go 4, 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 women at a time. But, you know, men especially, forget the talking.
I find it's always easiest to enforce the rules based on what your parental upbringing is, and that's the great excuse that you can use. And I've actually used this excuse in a situation with a boss. If he starts talking to me in the washroom, I always say, excuse me, my parents always taught me you don't talk in either during the washroom period or the national anthem.
Yeah, I like it. And when you kind of passing the buck to your parents, there's a little bit of an implicit shaming, too, I think, in the boss there. You know, leave me alone. Maybe you should have been raised a little better. Whew.
So people
I hope your boss doesn't take that the wrong way.
So people can check out the website, which is www.icbe.org. Do you get a lot of different tips and ideas from people and a lot of different customs from washroom use, either regionally or globally?
You know, I do, and I've gotten a lot of questions, and some of them, frankly, that I'm not 100% equipped to handle when it comes to the global bathrooms, but people often send in stories about their travels, pictures, tips. I had one guy who went on a trip for a few days, and he took, in a completely non-pornographic manner, a picture of himself going pee every single time he went pee on the trip. I mean, I've got some crazy stuff in my inbox.
And it's some things I'm sure people can take a look at and find out more about from the site. Again, the site is icbe.org, and it's the International Center for Bathroom Etiquette. Michael, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Michael Sykes, president of the International Center for Bathroom Etiquette. You can check out his website at www.icbe.org, and of course, you can also find the link to the International Center for Bathroom Etiquette on my website at thestufffile.com. Just go to the Stuff File page, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0123, and you'll find the links. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A lawyer's first rule of cross-examination is to never ask a question you don't already know the answer to, but criminal defendants who act as their own lawyers typically do not get that memo. Philomi Cesar, charged with about 25 robberies in the Allentown, Pennsylvania area, began questioning his alleged victims at his trial in November. "Please describe," he asked the first, "what the robbers sounded like," answered victim Darrell Evans. "He sounded like you." After Cesar asked a second victim the same question and received the same answer, he decided to stop cross-examining the victims. He was convicted, by the way, on 19 counts. Ah, yes, they say that someone who defends himself in court has a fool for a client, so clearly, this guy is an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0123. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And when you go to the website, you will find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's show number 0123. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags and mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.